You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja.
We love the herb.
It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Thursday, July 27th, 2017, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Oh boy, folks, I can't wait for today's show. We're going to have so much fun. Of course, as usual, we're going to start off with cannabis headline news. That's coming up right away. We got some great news coming out of the U.S. Senate, especially for medical marijuana patients that are afraid that the Sessions Department of Justice is going to be coming after their medicine. Great news coming from the Senate on that. Also, great news for adult use cannabis consumers in Michigan. Looks like they're halfway on their signature goals to getting legalization on the ballot in 2018. We'll give you more details. Also in Nevada, a constitutional case there where their Supreme Court decided about their medical marijuana registry. We'll update you on that, plus the rest of the marijuana news all around the United States and the rest of the world. In our guest segment today, we have our Police for Reform guest from Law Enforcement Action Partnership, Sergeant Steve Miller. That's right, Sergeant Steve Miller. I will not call him the space cowboy, the gangster of love, nor Maurice. But Steve Miller joins us from the Detroit area to talk about civil asset forfeiture. That's, of course, where the cops take your stuff because they claim you were involved in drug activity. And he gives us an idea just how insidious this is and how it works against the most vulnerable among us. And then, oh boy, the part I can't wait to get to, the Joker to buy Batman, Kevin Sabet, published an op-ed today on CNBC's website. First thing I saw this morning, I spent all day on it. And you know this if you're following my Twitter feed, at Radical Russ. I am taking a samurai sword to this op-ed and eviscerating all of his claims about how marijuana legalization is costing too much money and it's hurting too many people and it's a gateway drug and there's addiction. Oh, my God. He threw the kitchen sink into this op-ed. So this is going to be an extended rant. I'm turning the automation off. It's going to take me as long as it's going to take me. But we are going to go through that thing, point by point, step by step, and show what a bald-faced, bullshitting liar he is. So stay tuned for that. But of course, as I mentioned, every show starts off with the cannabis headline news. Let's get to it.
This is your cannabis headline news. Brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net, the complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your cannabis headline news for Thursday, July 27th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. Today, the Senate Appropriations Committee on Commerce, Justice, Science, and Related Agencies, or CJS, approved an amendment in a voice vote that would continue to protect state medical marijuana programs from federal interference. The amendment, introduced by Senator Patrick Leahy, a Democrat from Vermont, would add a clause to the CJS budget for fiscal year 2018 that prevents the Department of Justice from using resources to prosecute medical marijuana patients and providers that are in compliance with state law. A similar amendment was introduced in the House of Representatives by Representatives Dana Rohrabacher, a Republican from California, and Earl Blumenauer, a Democrat from Oregon. In 2014, Congress added a similar amendment to an omnibus spending bill that prevented the Department of Justice from spending any resources to target state legal medical marijuana businesses. This amendment was subsequently renewed, but now stands to expire. If the CJS budget is approved in the Senate, the amendment will go to a special conference committee to reach a compromise with the House. If no budget is approved by September 30th, the previous amendment will be automatically renewed for another year. A ballot proposal to legalize marijuana for recreational use in Michigan is gaining steam as the group raises more money and boasts it has gathered half of the signatures needed to put the issue before voters in 2018. A national marijuana advocacy group that helped legalize marijuana in other states is leading the charge for a Michigan plan to let people smoke marijuana without fear of legal repercussion. So far, the Coalition to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol has raised more than $818,000 in combined direct and indirect contributions, according to the latest campaign filing with the Secretary of State. The ballot committee, led by Marijuana Policy Project, reported over $518,000 in direct contributions and over $300,000 in in-kind contributions. The Nevada Supreme Court has upheld the constitutionality of the state's medical marijuana registry in a unanimous decision issued this week. The unpublished opinion, dated Tuesday, upheld a lower court ruling rejecting a challenge to the state's medical marijuana program approved by the voters in 2000. The challenge was filed by an individual identified only as John Doe, with other similarly situated residents. Doe sued the state and legislature, arguing the registry and fees violated his due process rights with his right against self-incrimination. A Clark County district judge ruled in favor of state officials, finding in part that Doe did not sue the right agency within the Department of Health and Human Services. The Nevada Supreme Court upheld the lower court decision, holding that Nevada's medical marijuana registry does not violate the U.S. Constitution's due process, equal protection, or self-incrimination clauses. California's Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom is openly courting donations from the marijuana industry in his bid to become governor in 2018. Cultivators, retailers, and others have given Newsom's campaign more than $300,000, according to a Los Angeles Times analysis of public records. As part of his aggressive fundraising drive, Newsom has become the first California gubernatorial candidate to solicit large sums from the cannabis industry, far eclipsing his rivals. The cannabis industry's open pursuit of political influence shows how a once underground business is becoming a part of the establishment. So far, donors with a tie to the plant have given more to candidates for governor than all other farmers in the state's agriculture industry combined. Since voters approved Initiative 502, FBI crime statistics show lower rates of violent crime in Washington than before legalization. According to the FBI data, in 2011, there were 295.6 violent offenses reported per 100,000 Washington residents. In 2015, the most recent full year of data available, that rate had fallen to 284.4 violent offenses per 100,000 people. Other data compiled by the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs showed some fluctuations in violent crime rates, but still found no statistically significant increase. According to those reports, in 2012, there were 3.6 violent offenses per 1,000 state residents. In 2016, that was 3.3. A new study finds that when courts order people to stop smoking marijuana, they often switch to using dangerous synthetic cannabinoid products like Spice or K2 instead. Researchers also found regional differences in synthetic cannabinoid use owing to different levels of legal acceptance of marijuana. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for Thursday, July 27, 2017. I'm Russ Belville.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal Potland, Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House.
Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com, City of Portland, permit number 17-159855.
You're not high. You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
I'm astonished to hear people suggest we can solve our heroin crisis. Have you heard this? By having more marijuana.
Okay, maybe you're a little high.
If you work in the cannabis industry, consume marijuana, or just support freedom, you need to know about breaking policy news that affects you. Marijuana Moment is the daily newsletter that helps you stay on top of all the latest and most important state, federal, and international cannabis developments. Brought to you by longtime legalization activist Tom Angel, Marijuana Moment puts a concise yet comprehensive overview of cannabis news in your inbox early every weekday morning. Wake up to Marijuana Moment and rest assured you'll be ready for the cannabis news that's driving the day. Subscribe now at marijuanamoment.net.
This is Police for Reform, brought to you by Law Enforcement Action Partnership at LEAP.cc. LEAP is a group of law enforcement professionals advocating for criminal justice reforms in the areas of drug prohibition, mass incarceration, asset forfeiture, community policing, and more. LEAP provides qualified speakers across the world to speak with authority on criminal justice issues. We visit with one such speaker now in Police for Reform.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Police for Reform, the podcast for Law Enforcement Action Partnership. I'm Russ Belville. Joining us today, we have Steve Miller, who's a retired sergeant who worked 20 years as a law enforcement officer, preceded by 4 years in Air Force security. So thank you for your service and welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Steve, one of the main reasons I wanted to talk to you today was to get an expert's point of view on the most recent developments coming from the Department of Justice. And that, namely, would be Jeff Sessions, our Attorney General, calling for greater seizures through asset forfeiture. And I was hoping you could explain to our audience exactly what he's talking about. What is this asset forfeiture, and how do the feds and the states use this against marijuana consumers?
Well, they use it against marijuana consumers because if they can put a case against you for delivery or manufacture of marijuana, for instance, they can come in and do a search warrant on your home, raid your house, and basically take all your money, everything you own, freeze your bank accounts, and whatever they can get in their hands and in their trucks, they're going to take from you. And that is that occurs all without any kind of conviction, criminal conviction, just merely a charge and a file of the forfeiture on behalf of the law enforcement.
And where this gets difficult sometimes to understand is we start getting these terms thrown around at the federal level. A couple of them were equitable sharing and adoptive forfeitures. And could you tell us what's going on in those terms?
You know, as far as equitable sharing, and I think they mean it's the funds are used to go back into the community, namely into law enforcement for training and equipment and things like that. And that's how they justify all this, but it's really becomes against our rights as American citizens with as little proof as they need to get to go into your house and take everything you own. You know, it's something that's in desperate need of reform, not enhancement, as Jeff Sessions is trying to do.
Yeah, I had read a statistic that said in 2014, the federal asset forfeitures actually exceeded the amount of property that was stolen by burglars and robbers in 2014. The cops are stealing more than the robbers. And part of this, that adoptive forfeiture allows, you know, you talk about us needing to reform these laws. Numerous states have
right.
Come up with laws saying you have to have a criminal conviction first. What is this adoptive forfeiture that allows the states to get around that?
Well, they operate then under federal law. And a lot of that goes through, you know, they have these drug task force out there that usually have a federal agent or two on them. And then they just go operate under federal guidelines and laws. And, you know, federally, marijuana is still illegal. You know, there isn't not even a provision for medical. And with it being illegal federally, they use their federal powers to come in and seize everybody's assets, and then the feds don't want to charge them, so they just charge it at a state level by the local prosecutor, but, you know, do the forfeitures under the guise of federal rule and law.
Wow. So even if your state does the right thing and requires a criminal conviction to seize your assets through this adoptive forfeiture, they can seize the assets through the federal law of marijuana being illegal. And then the equitable sharing allows the feds to then share back the proceeds with those state cops. It's an end run around state democracy, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is. You know, it was like you said, a lot of states have started making reforms to the civil asset forfeiture laws, and this is definitely a step backwards. You know, we got to get out of this mindset that the government can just come in and take all your stuff and ruin your life over some marijuana, especially.
Yeah.
In the states that are going to require criminal conviction, I think there's here in Michigan, there's something in the legislature right now that's trying to get passed that would require a criminal conviction. And you know, if they're going to be able to do it, I guess, you know, that should be, you know, their what they have to abide by and with a criminal conviction before they can, you know, seize and keep somebody's money and property.
Wow, what a novel idea. A court should actually adjudicate that you committed a crime before we can take the proceeds from it. That's right. Some radical thinking there, Steve.
I've been told I'm a progressive thinker.
I guess so. Well, let's look back to your experience. You spent 20 years in various service in law enforcement, from patrol to narcotics to detective work. Did this policing for profit affect how your department might go after crimes, like, you know, pick someone who's going to give you a better haul than someone who's maybe poor?
No, you know what, I would see where I saw a lot of failure in the civil asset forfeiture reform, or not reform, civil asset forfeiture, was that it was the more poor people, or, you know, lower middle class, or, you know, struggling people, that were the ones that got hit the hardest by this, believe it or not.
Uh-huh.
We had in Wayne County, Michigan, which was where I Canton Township was located, at the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office, had a program called Operation Push-Off. So you could, under their Operation Push-Off, you could see somebody's vehicle for really personal use amounts of marijuana or other drugs, and you would seize their car under Operation Push Off, and the person could get their car back. It's usually, you know, a car that is, you know, struggling itself and having a hard time getting itself, you know, getting the person back and forth to work. But we would seize the car, and they could go get their car back if they paid the prosecutor's office $900. And it was, at our department, that was almost like a stat. It was a good statistic, right along with the arrest. You know, you got your push-off on it, which would give you credit for a forfeiture, and you got some drugs off the street, and, you know, it's, you know, the officers would get praised for doing stuff like that. It was good police work that guy just went out and did. And meanwhile, this guy didn't get to work that tonight. You've seized his car that he's never going to be able to afford to go get, pay $900 to get it back, And those are the kinds of people I saw getting hit hard with this, you know, and that's the forfeitures that was going on. I never worked in a narcotics unit. I worked in our department's detective bureau, but that's where I would see, you know, these low level forfeitures that were occurring most of the time. I mean, we weren't getting big, you know, drug rings and drug dealers and all that, where,
which again, when they came up with that asset forfeiture, they said it was to go after the cocaine kingpins, the Miami Vice yachts, all
right,
that kind of stuff.
Yes, for major crime organization type things. I mean, that's what it was intended for, not to be, you know, kicking someone when they're down even further, you know.
Yeah, but as it works out, you know, you go after the kingpins, they've got money for lawyers. You go after somebody with a beat down, you know, Honda, they're not going to take it to court,
right,
and fight it.
No, because they can't afford an attorney that'll, you know, fight it for them. They'll get a court appointed that'll get them to plead to something, you know. So,
yeah. Insidious aspect of our criminal justice system that definitely needs to be reformed, and this call by the Attorney General to have more of this asset forfeiture is certainly retrograde and taking us back
absolutely
to a place we don't need to go to. Sergeant Steve Miller, I want to thank you for being here on our Police for Reform segment. Before I let you go, do you have any other contact information or websites you'd like to tell people about?
If people are interested in what we were talking about tonight, a big part of it, you can go to leap.cc, and that's Law Enforcement Action Partnership. And we are all about looking at the various areas of law enforcement that are in need of reform, and how we can publicly speak about these and hopefully change people's minds and get law enforcement back in the right direction.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. If you're a cannabis brand looking to build trust and awareness within the community, consider becoming a sponsor of this program. Your message will be seen and heard by the most dedicated followers of marijuana policy reform, who are loyal and supportive of those brands that give back to the community. Just log on to MJAgenda.com and click the Become a Patron button to learn how your brand can also be featured in my live nationwide appearances. Thank you for your support.
You're not high. You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
I was told by the DART Task Force in Toledo that they're actually sprinkling fentanyl on marijuana now.
Okay, maybe you're a little high.
The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville is proudly sponsored by the Marijuana Business Association. The MJBA, called by NBC News the Cannabis Chamber of Commerce, is the fastest growing business association and the fastest growing industry in America. I've been working with the MJBA for years, and I personally invite you to join the MJBA. MJBA also publishes the popular MJ Headline News on Facebook and the MJNewsNetwork.com and Marijuana Channel 1 on YouTube. Visit MJBA.net for more details.
Total war against public enemy public number one.
10 federal criminal penalties for up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Legalization is just another word for surrender.
I experimented with marijuana.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs. Use less
I am
drugs.
That was the point.
I think it would be a mistake to leave.
Negative reports coming out of Colorado.
Don't smoke marijuana.
Kevin Sabat continues delivering fake news on marijuana legalization. The Joker to my Batman, Kevin Sabat, is at it again. This time, he's posted an op-ed at CNBC entitled, "Legal weed isn't living up to all its promises. We need to shut it down." It is truly a masterful amalgam of reefer madness, junk science, and unfounded scares packed with more bullshit per square inch than a Fort Worth stockyard. Kevin begins by painting supporters of ending failed marijuana prohibition as pie-in-the-sky dreamers who are promising that legalization will, quote, be a panacea for every contemporary challenge we face in America, end quote. Then he provides links to stories detailing the positive effects of cannabis on the opioid crisis, cancer treatment, hurting drug cartels, and reducing greenhouse gases. It's really the only non-bullshit paragraph in the whole piece. I know the Joker thought readers would chuckle at such grandiose claims coming from the potheads, but with 60% support nationally for legalization and 83% for medical marijuana, I kind of think it's backfired on him. First, he starts with fake news on marijuana legalization's costs, saying, quote, "Drug use costs taxpayers more than $193 billion due to lost work, productivity, healthcare costs, and higher crime," end quote. Well, that's how Kevin backs up his claims that the money we get from legalization, remember, it's a half a billion bucks in Colorado alone, isn't worth it because it's offset by the harms of marijuana use on our economy. But a closer examination reveals his weasel words: drug use, not marijuana use. And when you click on the link, you find a study from 2011, not post-marijuana legalization. So, the Joker's $193 billion number is what society allegedly suffered before marijuana legalization from cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, PCP, GHB, LSD, ketamine, psilocybin, crocodile, K2, bath salts, designer drugs, and marijuana use. Then, when you look deeper into the study, you find that, quote, this is in the study, quote, "the majority of the $193 billion costs are attributable to lost productivity," end quote. Then they estimate that $120 billion comes from the lost productivity where, quote, loss of productivity as a result of incarceration costs society at least $48 billion annually, end quote, or almost a quarter of Kevin's scary number. Seems to me that legalizing marijuana and thereby not incarcerating able-bodied workers would then increase productivity, wouldn't it? The Joker also tries to weasel in some alleged costs from the dreaded stone drivers, saying, quote, a new study out of Canada found that marijuana-impaired driving alone costs more than $1 billion, end quote. Well, the study is from 2012, so again, it's before Canada's legalized anything. And what it considers a marijuana-impaired driver consists of data from a roadside saliva test in British Columbia that, quote, used a cutoff value of 5 nanograms per milliliter in oral fluid, saliva, spit, which corresponds with the limit of detection for THC in whole blood, 0.2 nanograms per milliliter, end quote. In other words, this alleged $1 billion in costs in Canada comes from crashes in 2012 involving drivers who were detected with at least 1/25th the level of THC in blood that Washington and Colorado consider a marijuana-impaired driver, when we know at least one Washington driver who drives only borderline at 11 times Washington State's 5 nanogram per milliliter legal limit. So you're attributing a lot of costs there to people who were just merely marijuana smokers at some time in the recent past week or month, not necessarily that they were impaired. And Kevin then warns that, quote, large businesses in Colorado now state that after legalization, they have had to hire out-of-state residents in order to find employees that can pass a pre-employment drug screen. End quote. All right, that's one way to look at it. Another way would be that some businesses continue to discriminate against able workers who enjoy their constitutional right to consume marijuana outside of work hours. Look, I bet if Colorado construction companies wanted to ensure that no worker would ever be hung over by forcing them to take pre-employment tests that detected beer drinking within the past month, they'd have to hire only Mormons and Muslims. Kevin also continues with the fake news on marijuana legalization's revenues. This is a thorn in Kevin's side. The problem for him is that marijuana legalization is raking in tax revenue for cities and states. He tries in vain to dismiss these figures by saying that we claimed that, quote, pot taxes could turn a state budget deficit into a surplus, end quote. Whoever said that? Nobody but the voices in the Joker's head. We've never claimed that pot taxes would make up 100% of a state's budget deficit. We have claimed that whatever we make in pot taxes would be infinity percent more than we collect under prohibition. Kevin even tries to puncture the pot taxes for schools promise by noting that Colorado's, quote, schools require about $18 billion in capital construction funds alone, end quote. Again, because his straw man said pot taxes would completely fill an entire budget shortfall. But what has happened in Colorado is that places like Pueblo County have used $425,000 in pot taxes to fund, quote, a $1,000 scholarship for every qualifying graduating high school senior to attend community college or state university. Last year, Pueblo County was only able to fund $50,000 in scholarships. Kevin then turns to Washington, where he claims that, quote, half of the $42 million of marijuana tax money legalization advocates promised would reach prevention programs and schools by 2016 never materialized, end quote. And you know what? He's right, but he's not telling you the whole story. When you click the link You learn that legalization advocates didn't break any promises. In 2015, the state legislature decided to move, quote, $100 million more into the general fund than I-502 specifically dedicated, which hollowed out I-502's basic promises aimed at teen prevention and education, end quote. Kevin continues with fake news on marijuana legalization's effects. He just can't help himself but to make his "it's not your father's Woodstock weed" pitch. He says, quote, "Today's marijuana isn't the weed of the 1960s. And he asks us to consider, quote, "the human fallout of increased marijuana acceptance," end quote. Human fallout? You want to talk human fallout? You mean like being raided and handcuffed and having your dog shot and your possessions taken, being locked up in a cage, your kids raised in foster care, being branded a drug criminal for life, ineligible for certain jobs, discriminated against for all others, all because you were growing a houseplant? That kind of fallout, Kevin? Gee, I mean, if the Woodstock weed was so comparatively innocuous, can we just legalize that? You know, kind of like how the initial alcohol re-legalization after Prohibition was just 3-2 beer. Now, the Joker claims we've had, quote, "an increase in drugged driving crashes," end quote, which once again supposes that someone in whose body you can detect THC is guilty of impaired driving. Tellingly, the AAA study that he linked to explains that, quote, "results of this study do not indicate that drivers with detectable THC in their blood at the time of the crash were necessarily impaired by THC or that they were at fault for the crash," end quote. Furthermore, that same study that Kevin linked to goes on to criticize Washington's 5 nanograms per milliliter per se DUID limit, explaining, quote, "there is no science showing that drivers reliably become impaired at specific levels of marijuana in the blood. Depending on the individual, drivers with relatively high levels of marijuana in their system might not be impaired, while others with low levels may be unsafe behind the wheel," end quote. Kevin also tries to claim that we've had an increase in, quote, "youth marijuana use," end quote, in the legalized states. So, to back up that allegation, he links to survey data that compares teen pot use from 2002 and 2003 to 2013 and 2014. Well, geez, Kevin, why not just compare teen pot use from 1802 to today? I'll bet it's way, way higher now. But when you talk to the state health officials in Colorado, they'll tell you that, quote, "marijuana use has not increased since legalization," end quote. Their counterparts in Washington state will tell you, quote, "rates of teen marijuana use have remained steady despite the changing landscape," end quote. The Joker also warns that post-legalization, states, quote, "continue to see a thriving black market," end quote. Well, there have always been underground marijuana sales, and there always will be. Cigarettes are legal, but there is an underground market in Lucy's, or single cigarette sales, and interstate smuggling from low tobacco tax states to high tax states. What drives the underground market, as the link Kevin posted notes, is its ability to undercut the costs of regulation and taxation that legitimate sellers must cover. His linked story notes the combined taxes in Colorado are 27.9%. And I'll let you know, they're 37% marijuana tax plus up to 10.4% state and local sales tax in Washington. And then it goes on to quote the head of the Colorado Association of Police Chiefs, saying that the key to breaking the underground market is, quote, "trying to find the sweet spot where the taxes are low enough that there's an incentive for people to go to the regulated stores." Basically, Kevin's telling us we really need to reduce state marijuana taxes, isn't he? Why won't Massachusetts and Maine listen to him? Kevin's also delivering fake news on his kinder, gentler drug war. See, after alleging all these harms from marijuana legalization, the Joker then makes his kinder, gentler drug war pitch. Quote, "one thing we know for sure is that incarcerating low-level nonviolent offenders in federal prisons is not the answer. Individual users need incentives to encourage them to make healthy decisions, not handcuffs. End quote. Incentives. One look at Kevin Sabet's Project Samuel website tells you what incentives he proposes for people who are caught under the marijuana prohibition he's fighting to maintain. This is literally from the Project Samuel website. Quote, possession or use of a small amount of marijuana should be a civil offense subject to a mandatory health screening and marijuana education program as appropriate. Referrals to treatment and or social support services should be made if needed. The individual could even be monitored for 6 to 12 months in a probation program designed to prevent further drug use. End quote. Let me translate that for you from Sabetese. Civil offense means decriminalized, which means the smell of it is still reason for cops to search you, and evidence of it is worthy of a fine, which could lead to jail if you don't pay it. Mandatory health screening means a forced medical evaluation you must pay for where your marijuana use will become a part of your permanent medical record. Mandatory marijuana education program means a forced stint in a marijuana propaganda class that you must pay for. As appropriate means everybody that's caught with marijuana. Come on, you don't really think a Sabet-approved pot screening board is going to say your use is perfectly normal and doesn't require rehab, do you? Referrals to treatment means a forced stint in a drug rehab where you're paying to take up a space better suited for someone struggling with heroin, cocaine, meth, or alcohol. And a probation program means 6 to 12 months of piss tests that you must pay for, probably some classes you have to pay for as well, and if you fail the piss tests, you're probably sent to jail. But what if you want to grow that cannabis plant for yourself? You know, put a little plant in your garage, in your closet, just to make sure you're not contributing to a criminal underground trafficking market or somehow funding violent transnational gangs and terrorists. Well, for that, Kevin's Project Samuel website, quote, recommends that production, distribution, dealing, and sale remain misdemeanors or felonies, end quote. Gosh, it's almost as if Project Samuel is staffed by rehab clinic owners and informed by drug test profiteers seeking to protect their cash cow of drug court sentenced clients, huh? Kevin's also spreading fake news about marijuana dependence. He concludes his whole op-ed with a link to a tale of someone with a life story that's somewhat similar to mine, who's now sober and participating in rehab for marijuana dependence. Someone whose dependence was so devastating that they, quote, got through 4 years at an Ivy League university stoned, and, quote, got jobs and worked my way up so that I could do what I've always wanted and write for a living, end quote. Oh, and by the way, for the rest of this, I'm going to be using the singular pronoun they, because the author of this piece identifies as a non-binary gender, okay? So if it sounds weird, it's just new. So in reading this person's story, it seems like their life on weed wasn't so bad, but then they, quote, drank and took drugs offered to me at bars without thinking twice about what these powders and pills were, end quote. They describe themselves as an, quote, anxious, dysphoric, trauma-laden human being, end quote. They talks about getting their medical marijuana card and going to dispensaries, quote, on my way from the bar, tipsy, end quote. Well, now, surely Kevin would argue this is the gateway effect. They started with weed and it led to drugs. Yet, I am damn near the mirror image of this person. I'm, quote, writing for a weed lifestyle magazine. I've got, quote, a weed leaf tattoo. I wear, quote, socks, jewelry, clothes, all patterned with leaves. I record, quote, a podcast that focuses on using. I've enjoyed, quote, sporadic use of other drugs. I consume marijuana, quote, from the time I wake up until I go to bed. I am working, quote, in a field that is hyper-focused on promoting the plant. I've even tripled their, quote, 8 years of chronic use. Now look, I have the utmost respect for their struggles with substance abuse disorder. It is true. A few people have a dysfunctional relationship with substances, even cannabis. Kevin says that helping people battle addiction, quote, can't happen in a climate that promotes use, end quote. My father was an alcoholic, and his relationship with that substance nearly killed him until he sought treatment and rehab. He got sober in 1980 at the age of 38 and hasn't touched a drop since. Somehow, he accomplished that in a climate that promotes the use of alcohol. However, my dad's struggles with alcohol are no reason to assume every drinker will face those struggles. My dad's alcoholism is certainly no logical reason to call for a return to alcohol prohibition. My dad chose to enter recovery. He wasn't forced into it against his will because some cop caught him with a beer. Neither should this person's battle with weed dependence justify criminalizing or pathologizing my responsible use of marijuana. Kevin Sabet knows he's losing this battle. Since he began Project Sam, we've quadrupled the number of legal states, added 11 more medical states, got the South and Midwest to at least recognize medical CBD, increased legalization support from 48% plurality to a 60% majority, added many bipartisan co-sponsors to federal marijuana reform legislation, protected states from interference from the Department of Justice, raised hundreds of millions in taxes, created tens of thousands of jobs, and left Kevin Sabet with just three states, Idaho, Kansas, and South Dakota, where any adult's possession of a few grams of any marijuana product for any reason results in an arrest. All he's gotten left now is fear, uncertainty, and doubt, plus the hope you don't read news headlines about marijuana and don't click and read the links in his scary op-eds. Too bad for him that Batman looks shit up. That's all the time we got for today. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow with more news you can use to help legalize and regulate. Until next time, take care of each other, Toker.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
You grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth.